on a slide here, but you will probably tell a story about something that happened here. Stories are what we remember. They're how they frame the way we think about the world. And they're very, very powerful. And I'm running out of things. Ah, excellent. Is it up? Great. That was perfectly timed. Thanks, guys. I really want to thank the 17 guys who've been working with me for the last 3 days to get this PowerPoint to work. They have done tremendous jobs. Okay. Somebody once said, if you are a person, you have a story. And that's true. And many of us have lots of stories. Stories actually define who we are. I love this picture of storytelling. Stories also transfer wisdom. They're the oldest form of communication we have. And you know when you've got a good story, when you get a smile like this on a guy's face, and he's looking at the storyteller saying, yeah, that guy, he's sort of telling it the way it is, isn't he? That's the kind of look we want. Now, because we're in a scientific conference, I did want to provide some epidemiological evidence that storytelling works. This is it. When a whole bunch of Christian guys got together and decided what Christianity was about, they decided to tell a story. This is the Nicene Creed. He was born of the Virgin Mary and became man. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He suffered, died, was buried. On the third day, he rose again in fulfillment of the scriptures. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. That is the way they decided to approach it instead of the Ten Commandments. That is the story. It is a journey of an individual who encountered a problem, who overcame the problem, and who rose above the problem. It is awe-inspiring, and it has produced enormous effects. Stories are very, very powerful. And these are the characteristics of a great story. There needs to be a hero. There needs to be a villain. There needs to be a journey. It needs a little bit of surprise, a message, and it needs to be awe-inspiring around emotion. Stories need to carry emotion. So the good Lord started out with the Ten Commandments. That did not work very well. How many of you remember the seventh commandment? How many of you have disobeyed the seventh commandment? Who remembers the seventh commandment? Just raise your hand. You're such a liar. Well, there they are. Number seven, is that one we're not supposed to do? Okay. Now, these have been around a long time. They've been in the same book. They were actually in the same book for a longer time than the other story. We don't remember data and admonitions as well as we remember stories. This is part of your story. These are some of your commandments. These are what you're supposed to do when you get immunized. And they're not any more memorable than the Ten Commandments are. People have trouble understanding what all that stuff is. Now, I'm supposed to see, I'm going to show you an example of a great modern storyteller, if we're lucky. Can you guys try to start it? There we go.
Et puis j'atterris ici. Oh, c'est incroyable. Hein? T'entends ça, chérie?
Ben oui, c'est fou.
Never underestimate the power of a great story. For those of you in the back, what he said was, "And that's how I got here." And the husband turns and says, "Honey, it's unbelievable, isn't it?" "Yes, I don't know how it happened either, sweetie." I like that story because it's about the seventh commandment, and we were sort of on a roll with the seventh commandment. That is a great story. Now, that is rule one that you all cannot abide by. That is the story that isn't true. But it's a great example. Let me see. Here we go. It's a great example of how a story can save your tail when you get in trouble. I have an immunization story of my own that I wanted to share with you of how a story saved my tail. This is a large immunization campaign in Ecuador in 1983. Immunization rates were about 30% in the country, and USAID decided it wanted to do something serious about getting kids immunized, and there was a series of mass campaigns. Highly publicized, and you can see villagers coming from villages all around to be immunized during these campaigns. First Lady got involved. It's all the kind of things you would expect out of a marketing campaign. And the logo for this campaign was these two little kids. And they were the brand. Everybody knew them. And after the first year, we did increase immunization rates, but not in kids under one. There was a lot of backlog of kids, and kids under one were not doing very well in the immunization campaign. When we went out and asked people, they said, "Well, you know, we're just looking at the Premi kids, and they're like 2 and 3, right? So that's what we're supposed to do, is bring our kid in when he's 2 or 3. So how do you solve a major mess?" You've just taught people something you didn't want to teach them. Well, the way was to create a story. And the story was about the two kids had a baby. And for a whole year after Carlitos was born, there was a huge contest in the country to name Carlitos. School kids were involved. Everybody got very excited about Carlitos' birth. I will tell you, our family planning friends were not terribly happy about this solution, but things happen. And this was a way of correcting a mistake we had made by telling a great story about two kids who had a baby brother. And this story resonated, and immunization rates popped up significantly in under ones in the 2 years after Carlitos was born. Now, we're faced with this kind of situation in which a grandmother says, "Hon, how are you going to immunize that child? What is that vaccination schedule I heard about?" And response is, "Cool it, Mom. We got Google. Google will know. We'll just check with Google." So she goes to Google, and she comes to your page, and this is what she gets first. And then she gets this. Then she gets this. This is a little bit cuter because it has, like, little pictures and stuff. But it kind of... Then they get this, which is a quiz about vaccines. I don't know if you know that people don't like to take quizzes. It's not what they like, because it just makes them feel dumb, because they don't know any of the answers. I know it seems like fun, but these are not stories. These are other alternatives for getting information across than stories. This is almost a story. This says, "Before vaccines, almost every child in the United States got chickenpox." That's a beginning of a great story. Before vaccines, and then what happened afterwards? And then it drops into the main symptoms of blah, 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 blah. Okay? So the before is a signal that, gee, maybe they're going to tell me a story. But then the story kind of died, and we dropped into information about the symptoms. There's no hero, there's no villain, there's no surprise, and a very, very short journey, which doesn't wind up anyplace. Now, the title of this is chickenpox, is varicella, and in parentheses, it's chickenpox. Just a slight piece of pretentious advice. Why don't you put chickenpox first if it's for people? If this is just for docs, you know, go ahead and use their language. But if it's for the rest of us, chickenpox would be the best thing to do. And then look at this little thing at the bottom. Emergency room doctor in Los Angeles commenting on how few patients are admitted for, oh, what the hell is that? And then that other thing. I don't even know if that's good or bad. I can't tell. I think we need to do something about vocabulary too, but that's not a story problem. So this is the key elements of a story. It is a journey. It has a hero, a villain, and a surprise. And there is a challenge during the hero's journey, which produces learning. This is the key part of a story. It's not just a story about anything. It's a very carefully structured story. John and Bergen and Catherine Milkman have been doing some very interesting work at Wharton on what makes a story go viral. And I wanted to share a little bit of this about, do positive or negative stories tend to go viral, is the question they were asking. Between August 30th and November 30th of 2008, every 15 minutes they sampled the New York Times stories, viral stories. They coded 2,566 of these articles. They looked at four things. Was the story awe? Did it have awe and inspiring in it? Was it sadness and a downer? Was it angry about injustice and unfairness? Was it about anxiety, fear, and worry? They controlled for all kinds of things you can imagine. They did a really good job of that, for the appearance of the story and the placement and the release time and who the author was and all those kind of things. They controlled for that. So they could just look at the effect of those four variables. These were the results. Stories that were positive went viral more than stories that were negative. That was a big surprise to me. I think all of us think negative stuff goes viral. But there were four categories, two of positive and two of negative. The positive ones included sadness stories and awe stories, and the negative stories included anger and anxiety stories. The sadness ones did very, very poorly. Stories about how bad things are don't go viral. And we tell that story a lot. We always tell the story, what happens when you don't? That's a key story in public. What happens when you don't? And that's a sad, downer story. And we don't like to share those stories. Awe was the one was the most important one of all. That's the one that really broke through. But anger and anxiety didn't do too badly. They didn't do too badly. They didn't do as good as awe, but they didn't do as badly as sadness. And we can understand that. We see a lot of angry, anxiety stories going viral. But the most important part of a story that made it go viral was whether it had an emotional content rather than a factual one. If it was something that was highly emotional, it tended to go viral. I want you to watch this now as storytelling experience.
Okay, Susan, and where are you from?
I am from Blackburn near Bathgate, West Lothian.
It's a big town.
It's a sort of collection of, villages. I think there.
And how old are you, Susan?
I am 47. And that's just one side of me.
Okay, what's the dream?
I'm trying to be a professional singer.
And why hasn't it worked out so far, Susan?
I've never been given the chance before, but here's hoping it'll change.
Okay, and who would you like to be as successful as?
Elaine Page.
Elaine Page.
What are you going to sing tonight?
I'm going to sing I Dreamed a Dream from the Miserables.
Okay. Big song.
Yeah? Yes.
Did you expect that, did you? No.
I dream of love of never
Okay. Many of you have seen that before. It is an awe-inspiring performance. But what I wanted to focus on for a few seconds is the storytelling that the camera did in that. We were told how to feel. The camera moved to the audience when it was skeptical, the face of that young woman saying, oh, Elaine Page, my butt. She ain't no Elaine Page, you know. We looked at the faces. The camera moved to those faces. When that first voice came out, we saw the audience explode. That was a story very carefully told by the camera people. So carefully told, we weren't even aware of it. We felt we were there. She was successful to a large degree because of her own talent and the enormous surprise that her talent had. But that was very much a story. It is a story that had a villain. The panel at the beginning who thought, oh my God, is this going to be a nightmare? We had a hero. We had a surprise moment when everyone was shocked. Their expectations were changed. This is a very key part of a great story. That moment when we change people's minds, when they're expecting something and they see something else. This is a powerful part of great storytelling. We have the awe-inspiring when the evil guy of all time sits there, breathless, watching this woman sing unbelievable. And then we even had a flawed hero. Heroes are not always perfect. Being flawed is right. She came off that stage like an idiot. Dancing off, she didn't know she was supposed to stand there. But it didn't matter. She was our hero now. These are the elements of a great, great story. And they were managed by the cameramen and the directors of this particular performance. Now, I don't mean to take anything away from her voice. But as a storyteller, it really was interesting to see. If the camera had only been on her the entire time. The other thing that's important, and you saw it in the first video and you're going to see it in the final video, and this is something, you know, we can't do in print, but it is the power of music. Music tells us exactly how to think. Watch your favorite movie without any music to it, and you'll know you're not supposed to know whether it's scary or exciting or loving. Music tells us how to feel about things. The emotional part of this story is what made it so powerful. And the learning in it, the message in it, was we were all being very cynical. It was the biggest wake-up call ever. So much so that Susan Boyle's name, which is not spelled precisely like that, has become the symbol for the underdog who blows them away. You can just mention that, and the people who've seen this say, oh, yeah, I know who Susan Boyle is. Oh, I'm sorry about this font. What this says, however, is that you guys have great stories, too. Tremendous stories. This picture is a story. The stories that could be written about this picture are so interesting. And in and of itself, it invites people to tell stories. There are detective stories about how vaccines were developed. Fabulous detective stories. Sherlock Holmes would be very proud. There are science fiction stories about what would the world be like without vaccines. What would it be like today if we had no vaccines in the world? Great story. It's a story about a misguided love story, about a mother so desperate to find an answer to her child's autism that she led a movement of fear against it. That's a powerful, powerful story to be told. I stumbled on this page when I was getting ready for this history of vaccines. I'm sure all of you know this page, but I was blown away. These little tidbits of who these men and women were who created these vaccines and how they were created are tremendous story potentials. People don't know this. They don't understand what you do. They really don't understand it. They don't know where these things come from. They don't know people made them. They think robots made vaccines. They have no idea that a person made a vaccine, a person with grandchildren and a wife and family. The impact of newer vaccines on diseases in the U.S., this is a powerful story. This is data that could be translated into a very powerful story. You have tons of facts, more than many, many communities in public health, that are just waiting to be made into powerful stories. Now, you've got some great storytellers working for you already. Shot by Shot, which I'm sure you all know, is a great program which gets real people to tell their stories. When I was in the UK, I picked up two stories, which I thought were interesting. A young pregnant mother was also diagnosed with a minor infection. Her fever spiked, labor was induced, and her child arrived healthy. But the mother remains in a coma after suffering brain damage. She never got the flu shot. Okay? Flu, the story here, the bottom line is flu is not only serious, it's an unpredictable and often misdiagnosed as a minor infection. And this is a story. It takes you on a journey. There's a hero. There's a villain. There's an event. There's something that happens. Unfortunately, the hero doesn't win. The hero comes out with a coma. Here's another one. 4-year-old girl named Amid was diagnosed with a minor infection on Christmas Eve. The next morning, 2 hours after opening her presents, she was rushed to the hospital with a temperature of 107. She died an hour later. Her father was a physician who couldn't get her a flu shot. They wouldn't give the child a flu shot. So this is a story which has many messages in it. Again, it's a journey, but it's a downer. It doesn't inspire you. It makes you angry at best. So right now we have in public health two basic things we do. We tell people what the commandments are, and we give them stories of what happens if they don't obey them. We need a third alternative, one in which problem solving is the point of the story, in which the story tells how a woman solved the problem she faced in getting her kids immunized. Not how she faced the problem, but how she solved them. How do you deal with so many vaccines? How are the millions of women who have also heard all this stuff, how do they decide? I have a really close friend who just had a son about a year ago. I was talking to him about the vaccine stuff, and he said, oh, yeah, my wife was really worried. She went all over, and she looked at everything. She was really concerned. But did she get the kid vaccinated? Yes, she did. Yes, she did. She finally decided to do it. Well, her story is the story we want to tell. How did she do that? How did she handle the doubt? And she had real doubt, and she was a very smart woman. What do you say to friends who say you're crazy? You shouldn't be doing this. Those are stories of real people that we need to tell. How people solve the problem. Not only the consequences of the problems that come after. And one of the advantages here is this supports a very positive, powerful norm. You know, one of the things emerging out of our war on drugs is the very powerful story that Dr. Bob Hornick, I think many of you know, discovered in his evaluation of the drug program. That in fact, the publicity about kids using drugs became a very slight normative feature for all the kids who weren't using drugs to say, I must be the only one. Man, there's this much publicity about drugs. I think I'll try them. There is a potential for too much publicity about anti-vaccine stuff. We need powerful stories about how people are solving that to create a sense that vaccines really, really do work. We've got to get rid of the stories about the opposition and focus on the fundamental. So these are the only points I wanted to make today, simply that I think you have a tremendous potential for making very, very powerful stories in a variety of mediums. There are certainly villains, there are heroes. Sometimes the villain is an idea, not a person. There's a challenge, there's a victory, there's a lesson that emerges from that. But most of all, it is a journey. It is something someone is going on. It starts someplace and it ends someplace, and it is an emotional journey. And you particularly have the opportunity to inspire awe and to show people how to solve problems. Not just what will happen to them if they don't solve it, but how are millions of women in this country, tens of thousands of families, deciding to get their kids immunized despite all the nonsense they're hearing about how it's dangerous. I want to show you one final video, which I think is the kind of story I'm thinking about. It's not exactly in our field, although I think this could very well be a video about public health. Let's see if I can make it work. Could you turn the sound up a bit? Just a little bit more. There you go. Thank you. Thank you. this story sort of lets us believe what every wife and daughter wants to be. There at that moment when they're needed. And the seatbelt replaces that. It's a story of challenge, of certainly emotion. I've played it several times without the music. It's a third as emotional as it is without the music. So there is tremendous potential, I think, in our field to move towards the kind of storytelling which creates really inspiring awe, not about our work, although there is some of that too, but about all the fabulous decisions that Americans are making to protect their health. Thank you. I hope this is helpful in some small way. What we give them is facts instead. We usually give them a problem, and they don't mind publicizing problems. But as soon as we tell them, you know, there's a problem, they go to try to find a real woman who is having that problem and interview her, get her on camera. The government's in a particular bind because the press doesn't seem to want to publish anything the government does right. It just doesn't seem like it's their job. You know, they feel not right about it. So you got to be really unusual to get them to publish something right. But if it's not about the government, if it's about the number of women who are overcoming the doubt about vaccines and how they're doing that and how they got their kids vaccinated, I think it's pitching them. I think it's forming it as a story, and I don't think it's easy. I mean, you know that.
Well, I guess the other thing that occurs to me is one of my takeaways from your presentation is that it's up to us to probably use other media where we have more direct control rather than ceding the control to others.
I think that's a really important point, too. Yep. Maybe giving the opportunity for some of these women to tell, you know, their own story, put them with a creative team. And it may not be something that CDC itself can do, but there are a lot of other people in the immunization community. Shot by Shot isn't a CDC program. You probably help them a little bit, but I don't think they're, you know, a program of CDC. So there's lots of opportunity for people out there. I think we have to get more of the facts about the stories, like that slide I show with all those guys who've made vaccines. You know, there's a kernel there, but some of you don't have to find out it's sort of what the journalist says. The first thing is, what's the story? You know, what's going to make it emotional and interesting? I think those three words, awe-inspiring, what were the other two? Anger and anxiety, sorry. Those three, you know, we got to tie into those, and we ought to be tying into the awe-inspiring. But they got to be awe-inspiring. They can't just be cool.
Bill.
And this isn't the only thing you should be doing. I mean, all the other things you're doing are working. I mean, it's tremendous. The immunization rates are very high. And I know you're disappointed when they go down what you're really hoping for, but you're doing really well. Sorry.
Hi, Alan Hinman from Atlanta. We have, I think, an increasing number of people who are telling stories now, but they're negative stories.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they're my child died of influenza.
Absolutely.
And that kind of thing. My takeaway, I believe, from you is that that's less effective than being able to have a story, for example, of a woman who said, I'm awfully glad I had Johnny immunized against measles because there was an outbreak in our school and he didn't get it.
Almost. I think what she needs to say is, I can't tell you how hard it was for me to decide this year to get my kid immunized. I heard this and I heard that and I worried about it, but this is what made me decide to do it. It was my doctor, it was all the evidence, or I read something someplace, but it's how the woman decided to overcome an obstacle. And the obstacle now is all the doubt. It's all those other things. It's all those things you're saying. And anxiety does create, I mean, look at Japan right now. I mean, a lot of reasons for anxiety there. Anxiety, it creates news. The news likes that kind of stuff. So we have to counter it with this other kind of story. But we still need a hero and a problem. I sometimes use, just because I'm a Star Wars fan, you know, if you think about Star Wars, that's That's the classic story. It's really not the story of Luke Skywalker. It's the story of Anakin Skywalker. It's a story of a guy who becomes Darth Vader. This wonderful, beautiful young man who's tremendously powerful, who becomes the evil guy in the universe, and then changes. That's the real story that's embedded in there. And of course, they were so good, they told a million little stories about other people all along. But that's the real, the hooker there. It's got to have what those women who got her kid immunized faced. It's the Hispanic woman who finds a way to talk to her mother about going to get legal aid for the abuse she's experiencing. Because when she goes to her mother says, "Look, honey, your dad beat the hell out of me. It's just what women are about. Just go back and be a wife." How did she overcome that? That's the story we want to get. How did that woman decide to go to get help? I think those are the powerful stories.
Bill,
you guys have been so patient. Yes.
With YouTube now, video is really prevalent. Like you said, everything is on YouTube. And budgets are tight, resources are slim. But I think the benefit of YouTube is that, you know, people are accustomed now to seeing homemade video that's shot with, you know, and sometimes I think those come off as even more credible in terms of the authenticity of the story. So maybe you can talk a little bit about telling stories on a shoestring budget.
I think you are absolutely right. It is authenticity that matters. People know within 3 seconds of watching a video whether the government made it, whether an association made it, whether it's a message from Moses. You know, you can just tell instantly. One of the videos that went viral, I don't know if you ever saw it, it's that little kid sitting in the back seat of his car, came from the dentist, and he's still high on the stuff, and he's asking, "Am I going to die? Am I going to be this way forever?" And it's just a dumb video. This father just stuck this camera in the back of the car. I mean, there is no production values. But it went viral. I mean, I think there were 60 million people who looked at that video. Now, that's another facet to a story. It's a story we can identify with. Parents could see that kid and say, "Oh, that could have been my kid. He's, you know, it's just the way it is." So there is this element of surprise and attachment and credibility which comes with the story. But you're absolutely right. Fancy production values, unless they're as fancy as this one, this last one. I mean, that one was just so spectacularly beautiful that it did. People knew that wasn't homemade, but it was so beautiful that they could put up with it. But they don't need to be. I mean, that's a very powerful point. Please.
Hi there. This has been a great presentation, and I get your point about the storyline. And we're really focusing because we saw some really good videos, and we're talking about videos. You held up the little handheld. But I'm actually thinking, how do I break it down to something even shorter, different medium, of both, you know, my flyer about flu vaccinations or my pediatrician and how do they communicate one-on-one with a parent. Like the story, if a doctor were to tell a story, not just you should get a vaccine because blah, blah, blah. Well, my sister-in-law had the same concerns and she went back and forth and she went to the web and finally, whatever the issue, what it was that made her change her mind, that's what we have to get our docs and nurses telling that little story, that little elevator story in like 2 minutes face-to-face.
Yep.
And if you have any example, I mean, that's my challenge now for thinking about my materials for the upcoming year.
Yep.
And if you have any other insights.
You're absolutely right on. Stories do not have to be in video with music and all that stuff. Let me give you an example. Let's suppose you read this headline. Teen drinking explodes in Arlington. Okay, that's a fact. I'll tell you another story, and I'll tell you another way to tell that fact. Stores selling booze to kids illegally have doubled in the last year. Now, that's a story. Why is that a story and the other one wasn't? First of all, it's a journey. It talks to you about time. Secondly, it has a villain, the stores selling booze. And it has a hero, the kids, who are just the victims. And it's a story which tells us how to act policy-wise. The first one misleads us and thinks we've got to have drug education for kids. That's not the problem. The problem is there are a bunch of guys selling booze illegally to kids. If we stop that, we can stop a lot of the kids drinking. Stories can be extremely short. They do not have to be very long. Some really good ones are, but they have to have that basic characteristic. A hero, a villain, a journey, and a message from it. Please.
Hi, this was really wonderful. Could you give us a sense from thinking about our issues of who the villain is?
Oh, there's so many.
Disease is one, right?
Disease? It could be. I'm a little hesitant to tell you people who could be villains because it can sometimes backfire on us. So I think we need to frame the villain as doubt, maybe, as fear, as anxiety. And then sometimes, maybe not the government, but somebody just has to call a bad villain a villain. You know, sometimes the tobacco industry, I'm sorry, it's just a villain. It just is, and somebody has to say that. I'm really glad you asked that question because the villain doesn't always have to be a person or an entity. It can also be something else. Thank you. Hey, Carol.
Hi there. I wanted to just pose whether there's a way to tell compelling stories without emphasizing the doubt and overcoming it. Because one of the things we found in a lot of research is, as you pointed out, the social norm is to get vaccines. And the more we raise the question, oh, I'm doubtful, I mean, you could have the negative impact of raising doubts when there aren't any. Like in the case when we did, when I say we, but it predated me, the HIV campaign where you always show it was social norms, not whatever,
right.
Promoting a positive social norm. If you had said, done the storyline about how two guys, you know, overcame the horrible barrier of using a condom, we didn't do that in that campaign that you remember that I'm talking about. Nobody else does, but we're talking in code.
Yeah.
But there's got to be a way to tell stories that don't emphasize a negative that you don't want to raise. And that's what our formative research has found. So I just want to pose that.
That's a really good point.
We need good storytellers, and we need good stories, but it doesn't always have to be to raise a concern that somebody may not even have had.
No, absolutely.
So, okay.
Yeah. I told you what the first law of good storytelling was, that you can't obey that one. The second law, though, is be sure the story that you tell is about something that's true. So I've been interested in tracking the anti-vaccine movement because I've been doing some work on fluoride recently, and there is an anti-fluoride movement as well. And you guys are lucky. The vaccine guys, anti-fluoride people are really nutcases. But I'm just waiting for them to say that the reason Obama attacked Libya was because Gaddafi was using fluoride to kill his people, and fluoride has become so expensive here, he wanted to go there and get their fluoride and bring it here. I'm sure that's going to appear on the fan website. I'm just absolutely positive of it. But I tried to find a single empirical study, communication study, which showed that the anti-vaccine message is actually having an impact on vaccine rates. I know all the reasons why we should be worried, but I just haven't seen a study yet that shows that it was. When I looked, I'm really not in your business, so I'm stepping over the line here now, but when I looked at the data from California on the whooping cough stuff, and I think it was something like 80% of the cases were Hispanics. So I figured, what does that mean? Hispanics more susceptible to anti-vaccine messages than Anglos? There must be something else going on there with that besides that. I think sometimes, particularly in the communication business, we look for message solutions to problems that aren't there. So the first thing about a good story is if it's powerful, you want it to be helpful. You want it to tell the right story. So Carol's point is really important. Be sure you have the right problem. And then say, when we got this problem, how can we build a story to help? And the last thing I want to say is stories are not the only or the best way to do a lot of our work. They're just one more way. And we need to balance them with all the other good things we're doing. they certainly shouldn't be replacing all the good things we're doing. Yeah. Have you got some data for me?
Well, I think the whooping cough outbreak in California, I think, is a somewhat different situation.
Right.
As I understand it, that is more likely to relate to the duration of effectiveness of the vaccine. We do have data showing that the number of children whose parents claim personal exemptions from immunization requirements is rising. And it is quite high in some places. We had an outbreak of measles in San Diego just a year and a half ago among children whose parents consciously did not vaccinate them because of concerns about
okay.
the vaccine.
Good. Thank you. I'll leave you with a really good book recommendation. I don't know how many of you read a book called How Doctors Think. You read that book? I think that is just an amazing example of all the kinds of questions we need to ask ourselves whenever we think we have, when we diagnose a problem. I'm not responding to what you said. but he has this, he's a physician himself who went through some serious medical treatment. His wife is a physician. And he sort of says the kinds of things that go through a doctor's mind which causes him to misdiagnose the situation. And as a communications guy, I found them tremendously helpful. And I'm only getting 50% of the proceeds of the book. So I'm not getting any proceeds at all. It's an old book. He's also a journalist. There's nothing particularly new about it. But if you haven't read it and you're interested in how all of us smart people make mistakes, well, I'm sorry, all of you smart people make mistakes. No, it's us. I'm not smart, but I make mistakes. How we make those and how we can avoid them, it's really helpful. Thank you. You all have been so patient, and it's 5 o'clock. It's just time to do something else. Thank you.